Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the tire.
Well, hello and welcome to the 17th episode of the Being Brilliant radio show. This is your host, Amy Hackett-Jones, happiness and high performance coach for being brilliant in the way you both live and lead your life and those around you. You can find me at www.amyhackett.jones.com. The Being Brilliant radio show is a deep and impactful look at what it takes to be brilliant. The show invites you, my listeners, to step into the very essence of who you are being as you show up to life. My guests bring a combination of inspirational teachings coupled with practical tools and essential life and leadership skills translated into actionable strategies so that our listeners may step away into being the very best version of themselves. Interviewees are high performers, thought leaders, game changers, soul activators, pioneers, dreamers, adventurers, wayseers, visionaries, as well as friends and family, those whom I believe live life brilliantly and who travel magically through life, shining their own light so others may do the same. And my guest today is most certainly no exception. Michael Heyman is an entrepreneur, author, and campaigner for business, and I would put extraordinaire on the end of that, and I'd also, to quote somebody who described him recently, call him a superhero of business. Welcome onto the show, Michael. It's a huge pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Amy. Pleasure to be on the show.
Now, that's
I don't know about the superhuman.
Well, that quote came from a description about you and your business and your business partner, Nick Giles. And I just wanted to tap into that because the guy who said it said, sometimes you come across good talent in PR, but just occasionally you can find a powerful campaigning business and economy boosting authentic group of communications advocates and superheroes. That's Seven Hills.
and it wasn't my mother that said that, I can guarantee. That was a very kind quote.
I think spot on from everything I know about you. So.
Well, thank you. It's a very nice way to be introduced. And I guess I'm very grateful for that. Take compliments in a difficult way. But I think it says something about perhaps the difference that we aim to make and I guess the kind of meaning that we seek to bring in our work, which means that by nature we're optimists. So we tend to look at doing good things. I think that usually means working with very good people.
Wonderful. And we will delve more and more into that. First, I want to talk a little bit about really who you are and your story of how you got to be where you are, because I met you in London, goodness, 10 plus years ago.
Well over a decade, Amy, I think. Yeah.
Well over a decade. And a lot has happened since then. Let's just roll back the tape a little way and start with your story and delve in.
Yeah. When we met, I was working for quite a large corporate marketing company for WPP, and I was very much in the mindset that my future was about working for people and not working for myself, and that was partially, I think, because of my own background. My father and my grandfather were both entrepreneurs, and they wanted something different for me. They often I think they were very, very reflective of the environment, which was that entrepreneurship was something you did if you couldn't do anything else, if you couldn't be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever it might be. And Of course, it shows you the cultural shift, you know, that we've gone through in just a generation when you think how many people really want to do it for themselves. So when we met, I guess I was in the last embers of that. I was working very much for a global giant, but my heart was telling me that it wasn't really my path. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And in many respects, it was about finding the courage, about finding the partnerships and people and the ideas that could allow me to really seek out a more independent life. And that meant having a go and starting something up, which we ultimately did in 2010. But it was a fairly circuitous journey. I mean, I was quite old by comparative standards. I was just 40 when we launched Seven Hills 7 years ago, so you can guess my age. When you look at the age profile of entrepreneurs today, it tends to be a much, much younger one. I think people have overcome many of the sort of self-imposed psychological barriers that stop you starting things.
Absolutely. And that's very true what you say about the younger generation today. Those millennials, sort of the 21 to 28-year-olds, are just kicking it in terms of getting online and making businesses for themselves and traveling around the world with their laptop lifetimes.
Absolutely. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful change, because I think when you look at how the barriers to entry have collapsed, I mean, it means that in the UK right now, there are 80 companies an hour that are registered. I mean, it's a phenomenal change.
Wow.
It's led to this sort of massive stock. I mean, there are over 500,000 businesses a year that are registered in the UK right now. And it's a wonderful thing to be a part of, because I co-founded, along with my own business, Seven Hills, a year later, I co-founded a campaign called Startup Britain, which was very much about the startup culture and how, you know, we needed more people to feel that they weren't the barriers that perhaps they thought they were in terms of setting up your own thing. And at that point, startups were falling off a cliff. I mean, we were not the powerhouse for early stage businesses that the UK has ultimately become. And I think being part of that culture change, that culture shift, has been a massively exciting thing, really, to be a part of. And it brings great meaning, I think, in terms of your own sense of, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I think encouraging people to have a go has been one of the most fantastic things I've ever done.
Wow, absolutely. And what was it really that clinched it for you, that sort of you said you had this desire or this itchy sort of feeling that you wanted to go off and do something different, not necessarily the corporate work life that you were in at the time? You wanted to go off and do something on your own. What was it really that was that itch that had you, or that courage that had you sort of step over the edge? What was that? Did you have a light bulb moment or something, or was it just something you gradually built into?
Yeah, I think there was a growing sense of, you know, almost distress that I felt perhaps my time was about to be missed, because I'd just got married. I was, you know, hopeful about becoming a father and, you know, ultimately becoming a father to two wonderful girls. And so I had this sense that my commitments would increase. But when you start a business, I mean, obviously, you have nothing really on your side bar your ability to go out there and earn a living. You know, you're not salaried in the same sense as perhaps you've been used to. So yeah. I had, I'd grown quite resistant to the idea, mainly because I was reasonably successful in a corporate environment. I'd found that I could navigate and operate there. I just wasn't happy. And
right.
So it came down to a question of, was I prepared to put the bet on myself that would give that energy a chance to be released, and that happiness, a quest to be fulfilled? Or was I prepared to go on and I sometimes wonder the person that I would have been if I continued down that road. But you see, I think I then come back to the background that I had in terms of this quite quirky entrepreneurial background of my own, which you know was always there and it was always prodding at me, always in some respects rejecting the advice that I'd received, because you know I really do believe that the freedom that, that running your own business gives you, not only economically, but I think at a reasonably sort of human and soulful level, I think, in terms of the chance to try and live the life you want to lead. And I always think that would be the epitaph that you would want read, that you led a life worth living. And I think that that sort of, you can find some of that in business, right? You can find some of that in being an entrepreneur. But of course, you know, stacked against you is the day-to-day experience, which is, you know, you may think you're not good enough. Lots of people around you think it's a, you know, fairly sort of reckless decision. I mean, the amount of people that thought I was insane at the time of doing it, I mean, I would actively go out there and thought I needed to be saved from myself. You know, why would I want to give up this job and all the rest of it? But I found I had an amazing supporter in my wife, Claire, and, you know, she was absolutely terrific. I mean, she hadn't married me realizing I was about to quit my job. Which I duly did. And of course, you know, you're then out in a sort of very, very different environment. And but what I would say is that all the things that I feared about myself turned out to be relatively unfounded. I think I had more in the way of depth to sort of withstand, you know, the sort of rockier journey that being out there sort of throws at you. And I think that I found a creative energy, frankly, that I haven't had at any other time in my life.
And I want to dig more into the creative energy in just a moment, because that's something that, as an entrepreneur as well myself, it's something that I sort of never believed I really had until I got into this position myself as well. So we'll delve into that in just a moment. I want to look, first and foremost, before we delve into Seven Hills more, I want to look at Startup Britain and some of these other projects you've started and co-started, such as Pitch at the Palace as well. Because you really, it's not just, the company you've set up is not just another company. You guys have really gone out there and created space and opportunity for people to step out exactly as you have done, and to find that inner drive, that inner depth, that inner creativity. And you've provided a platform for people that, since we reconnected a year or so ago, I've only seen a glimpse of what you've been up to in the last 10 years. But I'd really love you to just share a bit about each of those projects, because they're just so fascinating and brilliant in their own way. So please do.
Okay, I wouldn't want to overclaim on Pitch at the Palace. I wouldn't describe myself as a co-founder. I think I'd be a great supporter, hopefully, it would be said, of it. And I think it's illustrative of the sorts of things, you know, that help inspire people when they most need it. It's an initiative created by the Duke of York. It looks at early stage businesses with high potential, and it provides them with a platform which ultimately sees a great many of them pitching at St. James's Palace to really awesome audiences, from investors to potential mentors. It's a competitive environment. It also shines a really valuable spotlight, not only on those businesses, but I think the whole endeavor of, you know, inspiring innovative young businesses that need to make connections. And I think, you know, that making connections has been something that I've always really enjoyed. I'm very motivated by people and their stories. Startup Britain was very much in the similar vein and came somewhat earlier. You know, so six entrepreneurs, of which I was one of them, we met together, had a chat about the sort of things we wanted to do and be involved with, and we all came to the same conclusion that we wanted to do something which was about barring the entrepreneurial culture, which is that, you know, people have got a great opportunity to live up to their full potential, and business can often be the mechanism to allow that to happen. So we met Lord Young of Grafham, who was then about to be reappointed as the Prime Minister's enterprise advisor. And we created a campaign which had very much the support of government at the time. It was launched by the then Prime Minister David Cameron, very closely associated with Startup America in the States, which President Obama had put his support behind. And it really reflected, I think, the changes in the economy that have happened, where actually wealth creation requires more companies, it requires more kind of entrepreneurs. It's interesting, there's a stat that's doing the round at the moment in the run-up to the US presidential elections, which is that 40% of US GDP is dependent on companies that are under 15 years old. So it's more than just doing a good thing. I think it's about doing a really vital thing, which is that we need more companies that can create the world beaters of tomorrow. And so the practical response to that were these campaigns that we really got involved with. And Startup Britain, I think, was perhaps one of the best known of those. But it's been great to meet entrepreneurs right the way around the country, everything from bus tours to major events to connecting brilliant people. I mean, it's been really exciting. But I think, you know, one of the perhaps the other initiative that I'd point to about things that we came up with was we co-created the country's first entrepreneur festival called MADE, and it took place in Sheffield. Now, Sheffield is my hometown, it's the Steel City, and it's a city that I've always believed in terms of having real potential to realize, mainly because it has a real reliance on self-made people, self-employed people, in terms of its local economy. So we created the MADE Festival to really be the big gig for entrepreneurs in the UK. We ran it for 3 years. It's been absolutely amazing. We had, at the last one, we had 3,500 young entrepreneurs at the City Hall in Sheffield. It was more of a rock star gig than it was perhaps a business event, in terms of just how exciting it is, you know, young, hopeful people that want to create an entrepreneurial path. And I think these are the sort of things that create the mood music, and they create the enthusiasm and the vitality that make it possible.
Well, this is fantastic, because there is definitely a certain buzz and energy around the entrepreneur sphere. So if anybody would like to follow or find out more about Startup Britain, you can find them on Twitter at Startup Britain. And again, Pitch at the Palace, at Pitch at Palace. You can find them both on Twitter. They're very active there in those campaigns. How can we find out more about MADE?
You would go to madefestival.org or Google MADE the Entrepreneur Festival. Can't quite remember what the Twitter handle is, actually. I haven't brought it with me, but it's pretty visible. And I don't actually do MADE now. I did the first 3 years.
Right.
So I'm still involved as an occasional speaker, but I wanted to do something which was a kind of vitamin shot. So it had a time-specific commitment. So we did 3 years, so nearly 1,000 days of it. So it was great.
Wow, fantastic. Just amazing. So let's take a look at Seven Hills now, your company that you began with Nick Giles.
Yeah.
Just tell us a little bit more about the company, because looking through your website, as I've been doing my bits of research and reading about you, you have, not only do you have values, but you also have personality and characteristics, which I thought were very interesting. And I'm going to start with values. And as communications experts, you will tell me more about this. But I've come across companies quite a lot when I've gone to consult as well. And more often than not, people don't know the values. Secondly, they have 6, 7, 8, or 9 values, which is far too many as far as I'm concerned. 3 is usually perfect. And so I'd just like to know why you chose 3 and why you chose these 3, ambition, personality, and team.
Well, I suppose to, in answering that, I'd go back a step. So we founded Seven Hills in 2010 in the teeth of recession. And I think you needed ambition, personality, and team to make it in a very, very tough climate. And, you know, we didn't, I mean, I'll start with the last one. First of all, team, which is hugely important to us. I mean, we never created Seven Hills, you know, with just the founders in mind. We didn't use our surname, Heyman and Giles, to create it. We wanted to create a brand that people could really buy into. And funny enough, Seven Hills is also the you might know, the city of Sheffield is built on Seven Hills, which my business partner came up with that idea. So why don't we call it that? Which saved us a fairly big branding job. I think the ambition piece is that we have always seen our work within the context of growth and enabling organizations to grow, whether that's in terms of their own business performance or indeed their own personalities or indeed their people. And we, you know, our own belief is that companies need belief, you know, and you build that sense of an ideas-based organization through your communication. So we really did feel that ideas were hugely important in terms of our ability to deliver those. And so that brought us very much out to the proposition that we see ourselves as campaigners. And I think that perhaps is, you know, the sort of the summary of those three core ideals, is that what it allows us to be is activists in our own way. It allows us to have a huge sense of ambition in terms of what it is that we're doing on behalf of our clients. It encourages, I think, to think big in terms of what it is we're trying to deliver. But I think that it also provokes perpetual sense of optimism, firstly in terms of a never say die approach to the day job, but also in the belief that we are there to build part of an optimistic future by helping our clients do better. And I think that is how we see it. And that's, you know, I think that sense of meaning and purpose is something that our team buys into massively. I think it provides us with a fairly unique point of differentiation amongst many of our competitors. I think it self decides the sort of people that we work with, because in many respects, they have a character, quite often, which is quite similar to us, I'd say. And I think it allows us to carve out our small niche in the world in terms of the sort of things we want to do.
Small niche in the world. And you've been recognized as the world's best corporate consultancy by the Holmes Report.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I think, what is it that I think Churchill said that attitude is a small thing that makes a big difference. And I think we from our point of view, is that we realize that we are one small cog in much bigger wheels, but we are passionate about that small cog.
Yeah, which is very evident. So personality would be the next thing that struck me as I was reading through. Personality, and that you've included commitment, promise, and belief. Now, that aligns with, obviously, with what you've just been talking about, seeing yourselves as campaigners and activists with ambition, thinking big, and lots of optimism.
Yeah.
Why did you then therefore include personality? Because that's not something that many companies would necessarily think about including. They sort of get to vision and values, and that's usually as far as they get.
Well, I think the personality of the brand and the organization struck us as being important because of where we sit. And I think that, you know, we are a consultancy after all. We, you know, our daily work is about representation of our clients, and some of our own work as well, I guess. But there is a certain amount of ubiquity amongst the consultancy sector. More generally, both in terms often of the sorts of work that people are prepared to take on, or indeed many of the values, which you could say are fairly sort of, interchangeable. And what we believed was that we wanted to work very, very hard on the what we stood for, which is expressed by the personality, you know, that we are mm-hmm. pro-business in our belief that business can and must be a force for good and change in society. We are 100% of the belief that actually when you look at a world which can be quite dark in places, if you want to shine a light on some of its brightest achievements, you can find those in business. And we believe that our personality should not be about representing people that we saw as almost like a sort of the pain thing to do. We actually saw it as being the absolutely brilliant thing to do, which is that we believe that we can help articulate and narrate the adventure that some of the very best in business are on. And of course, you know, we ultimately wrote a book about it in Mission, but I think it formed from the earliest days a reflection of we wanted to be a business with personality, and we wanted to take on clients and assignments that very much had this real sense of future potential and by its nature personality embedded in them.
That's just brilliant. And you've really brought something home to me then as you were talking. A few years ago, I was living in Panama, as you know, and I was studying leadership and ancient wisdom teachings with somebody I ended up working with for a while. And he said to me one day, he said, "Where does the future lie?" And I sat there and I thought, "What do you mean, where does the future lie?" And he wouldn't answer that question for some time. I had to go away and think about it. But for the sake of the radio show and for the limited time, he said, "The future lies in language."
Brilliant.
Isn't that absolutely brilliant? And everything you've just said right there about future potential, about helping your clients and to articulate and narrate their stories, and creating new stories and looking for stories that shine a light rather than, you know, the darkness and the heaviness. Because there is, it's almost like what you focus on, you get more of. The more we focus and shine a light on the great stories and tell those, the more energy we're giving that, the more energy we're feeding positivity to the world around us. That just came to mind just then. I thought
I totally agree, and I think it's there are other sort of ancient cultures that would absolutely, you know, subscribe to what it is you're saying. I mean, there's a wonderful old Indian proverb which basically makes the point that if you tell truths, you know, you may well understand, you know, facts you may well believe, but if you tell stories, it will live in your heart forever. And I think, you know, this is the key point, which is that we, you know, storytelling is as old as language itself. I mean, since the dawn of time, we have explained things in terms of stories. And of course, they provide the structures by which belief is forged. And I think our view has often been that, you know, those people that believe that deeds alone or action alone will be, you know, the tool that will allow them to sort of tell of their works, miss the point that actually the storytelling that goes alongside it is a really important factor in the winning of hearts and minds. And I think that, you know, whereas you can often see the negative side of that reduced to things like spin and, you know, sort of all the negative sides of it, I also think that where we find things to believe in, quite often what we believe in is the story that is being narrated. So I therefore think that the authenticity and our sort of role as good brokers in this, actually finding, you know, the stories, the people, the companies, the ideas that are worth believing in, I think that's an important part of why we are who we are. You know, I mean, I think that the thing that I can say looking across the business is that we work with some phenomenal people and they have stories that literally jump off the page. And I think you're right. I think that they are very much about how the future is created, because those stories, those ideas inspire people to act, and by their actions and by their activism, we create change.
Wonderful. And that's so true. And I'm just coming to this last point I wanted to talk about in terms of values and personalities, you've also got characteristics. And you've just described your team right there. The characteristics you've got are grip, pounce, bite, and surge. I just think that's absolutely grip, pounce, bite, and surge. I mean, that's just phenomenal.
Yeah,
it
sounds
tells
like,
a
sounds
lot.
Like, yeah, or cage fighting, I think. But well, I mean, so we obviously we're a few years in now, and we believe very much that we are. You know, we have the privilege of operating very much in a space of the economy which operates at an accelerated pace. So many of our clients are the technologists and innovators that are creating the kind of breakthrough, the breakthrough ideas that do change the world. And we identified in the book what one entrepreneur described as this idea of dog years, right? Which is that, you know, we all know as dog owners that unfortunately for every one of our years, they're like 7 years for a dog. And guess what? This new economy is no different. So for every new human year, it's like 7 old years. And what we realized was that in that environment, you needed to have different attributes if you wanted to prosper. And so we did indeed create the sense of grip, bite, pounce and surge as being really the ideal attributes of the Seven Hills person. And you know, grip and bite are closely related because I think they sort of attest to a sense of competency and commitment in terms of controlling your brief, of being on top of your work, actually sort of never letting go. Actually, the bite is another terrier. I'm a terrier owner. Is another terrier sort of doffing of the cap. But the pounce, I think, also speaks to a more opportunistic value, which is that you should always be ready to jump on things, always ready to see the upside in situations. And the surge really is about how does a small team make a big difference? And the answer is you have to punch through in areas of real focus. Surge was it's based on old military doctrine of how does an inferior army in terms of numbers make progress, but it's technically superior, make progress against a technically superior army in terms of numbers, but inferior in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. And the answer is you punch hard in one area. And we often thought that in business was that there was an element of sometimes you've just got to roll the dice. You've got to throw the resources that you have available. And that the prize for that is that you break through. And I think that is, you know, in a lot of ways, what we're about. We're about helping those companies break through.
Wonderful. And talking about breakthrough, your book is called Mission: How the Best in Business Break Through.
Indeed. Yeah. Good segue.
Yeah, exactly. So just so that people listening in know who we're speaking with, this is Michael Heyman. Amy Hackaden speaking with Michael Heyman of Seven Hills, and their website is wearesevenhills.com. So, Mission, tell us a little about your book, How the Best in Business Break Through.
Yeah, well, I think in many respects, Mission has sought to capture some of the journey that we've been discussing, and it is about the entrepreneurial economy. It's about how the best have done it, how you might consider doing it yourself, what are the lessons, what are the learnings. We felt that we had this sort of wonderful cockpit view of the changes in the UK economy specifically, but similarly, you know, through lots of visits to the West Coast and the States and other big cities, we'd seen how it was that certain brands seemed to be emerging really very quickly. And so we felt that that we needed to write about it. And out came the book, Mission. We spent a year putting that together, telling the story of 35 breakthrough brands. Some of the better known names were people like Airbnb, Whole Foods, lots of sort of I think companies that people would like a lot in the States. They call the firms of endearment. But we also included some of those businesses that also seem to be on a mission that maybe people might not like as much, maybe Uber and Amazon and so on, because of their potential changes that they represented to the way that we do business, the way that we travel, where their story was perhaps not seen as such a universal good. So mission sought to narrate things that were happening right now. But I think, you know, the main thing for us was that we took out of it was that purpose in business really matters, and actually standing for things which are about the changes that business can be a part of and the good that business can do is something that needs to be championed. And we feel very strongly that mission has made a contribution to that. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. It's been a very successful book for Penguin, mainly because I think it has captured a certain sense of the zeitgeist, which is that business has to do more than just earn money. Business has to stand for things, to retain talent, to attract customers, to grow, is that you cannot have profit without purpose. And mission really has sought to make the case in a very clear way that people want meaning in their lives, and they have looked at other ways in the past, ranging from the state to organized religion. I think today, increasingly, people look to business for some of that sense of belief, some of that sense of future direction. That puts an additional responsibility than just the delivery of the day job.
Yeah, and it's almost sort of gone are the days of corporate social responsibility as well. It was sort of that was like a tick in the box sort of thing that companies did for a while, but it's moved far beyond that now.
Oh, I think it's moved massively beyond it. In fact, I think if you were looking for a job spec that may well die a death in the next 10 years, I think corporate social responsibility officer probably would be fairly high on your list, because I think that it can no longer be the job spec that lives, you know, on a corridor half a mile away from the corporate head office. I mean, this has to be within the DNA. It has to be increasingly, you know, part of the mission critical sense of what an organization is about. Because I think, you know, where CSR tended to prosper was where organizations sort of almost felt like, we'll do the day job, now we'll do some good. Now I think increasingly, in an age where you see radical transparency in social media, you see a complete, you know, requirement of the consumer no longer to be treated like a prisoner, that people really demand that business is better. That means that you can't just opt in through a CSR department or a philanthropy scheme. You have to have good at the heart of the organization, good at the heart of the business. I think, you know, I think whereas right now, I think that this is a debate. I think in 10 or 20 years, it's exactly what we're just going to expect from business.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely the way it looks. Well, we're going to take a short break right now. We're going to play Michael's choice of song, which is Sunny by Marvin Gaye. Here we go.
Filled with rain, Sunny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Oh, the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sweet. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunshine, you came, oh, sunny.
Sir
Wonderful.
Michael.
Goodness, I didn't remember that bit in the song.
But tell us, why does that song get you in the mood? Why does that, apart from being called Sunny, which is just obviously sun shining, sun elevates all of our moods, but why did you choose that one?
I just think it's so beautifully written, and it's catchy. I mean, I was just sort of sat here clicking my fingers, listening to it, and just thinking, you know, it's one of, I defy anyone really to listen to that without smiling. I mean, and it is, I think it's a great sense of wonderful optimism. I mean, you know, I mean, good on him for having written it. I mean, you know, he was a man with his own challenges in life, but here was this song about love and brightness and the sense that actually the best is yet to come. And I think that for anybody of an optimistic disposition, somebody who believes that, you know, there are bright days ahead. And also I think, you know, there's a great sense of thanks and gratitude in the song for, in this instance, a person, but I would interpret it as the people that really do make your life that place worth living. And I think that, you know, it's an absolutely wonderful ode to love, and I think as such it's a brilliant, uplifting piece of music.
Wonderful, I couldn't agree more. So that was Sunny by Marvin Gaye, which can be downloaded at iTunes. So I just want to go back to your book just for one moment, and then we're going to delve into some takeaways that our listeners can go away with after today to go work on their own mission and their entrepreneurial escapades. So in chapter 2 of your book called Campaigning, and there's a quote by Eliza Dushku, go big or go home, because it's true. What do you have to lose? I think that's absolutely brilliant. And just in the first paragraph, you say, if the first fundamental part of being successful in business today is having a clear mission, then the second is becoming a commercial campaigner.
Yeah.
So I'd like you just to talk a little bit about how people can find their mission, and firstly, and secondly, how can they start, how do you define campaigning, and how can they start their own campaign?
Yeah, okay, good question. So, I think, first of all, to qualify the go big or go home quote, I mean, I think everybody has their own view about what that means. But I think that, you know, what I would say is that my take out of what mission is all about is the sense that there is a best you, a better you, if you will, that's out there to be, you know, to be got hold of. And I think business can often be where you find that person. And the real activation of that future potential is very much this sense of mission, which is, what is it that I want to do? What is it that I want to basically go out there and set up a business to actually achieve? Now, we often tell the stories of some very successful people in the book, but you know, I just use them to illustrate this sense, right? Which is that a brand like Ella's Kitchen, we interviewed Paul Lindley, the founder. Now, any parent will probably know Ella's Kitchen as a highly successful baby feed. But, you know, for Paul, it was very much this issue that he just didn't want his kids eating sugar, his daughter in this instance. He had a real sort of problem and great fear about the consequences of childhood obesity, and he felt that business was the best tool, the best way of dealing with that, and of course so he was proven to be true, because he's created a brand which is synonymous with good things in food for kids. He's been phenomenally successful as a result, but it came back to a fairly simple, straightforward mission that I think has driven the growth of Ella's Kitchen and driven its success. So I think, you know, think about mission in terms of really the difference that you feel you can make. Sometimes it can be the difference that only you can make. You know, when we looked at our sector, we wanted to create very much a campaigning communication business because we felt, you know what, we had the combination of skills that nobody had, nobody else seemed to have. We felt that was an audacious sense of goal. We had a great sense of people to emulate. So we really were very inspired by the story of the Saatchi brothers in the 80s and how they created those campaignable ideas. And that started to help us with our sense of mission, that sense of campaigning for growth and campaigning for the people and the firms that were capable of it. And I think that once you start to understand it, you can start to work with it. You can start to campaign with it. And you know, when I look at a brand, say like Virgin, I mean, we were very lucky in our first year of business was that we worked on a project for Virgin Media, which meant that we co-authored a report with Sir Richard Branson called Disruptive Influence. And it gave us a really great sense in terms of putting that report together about how mission is often there staring you in the face, that actually for Virgin, this sense of irreverence, this sense of what they ultimately defined as screw it, let's do it. You know, this whole idea that there was an adventure to be had. And by that adventure, you could create better ways of travel or better ways of buying goods and services. That actually that could be at the heart of a really successful business. And guess what? You could go out there and campaign with it. It wasn't just about the one man in terms of Sir Richard Branson. It was about a culture that he could then seed and democratize into the organization. So I think that, you know, starting to think about the higher purpose of the organization, what it is that you're hoping to do and achieve, is time that is really worth spent. And, you know, and it's amazing how few companies can really answer in convincing terms what it is that they really stand for. And if you can't answer that question, I think, first of all, you've got to answer or worry really about the products and services that you offer. But also, you can hardly then go out there and really campaign and communicate about them if you can't answer those questions yourself. And I think they're so vital now. They're so important. Very, very good research about millennials at the moment, which shows that by 2025, millennials will be over 70% of the world's workforce. This will be the most ideas-driven, socially attuned generation that's ever lived. And they're looking for more out of their organizations. And I think that unless you have this sense of mission, you've basically got a workforce with one foot out of the door. And I think this is part of the sort of, you know, immense self-interest that there is about organizations that stand for things. Because guess what? We want to work for them. We want to buy from them. We want to see them prosper in the future.
Yeah, that's incredible. So yes, I mean, I'm seeing that shift as well, and it's specifically having an online business and in the online sphere that the millennials really are beginning to shape the future.
And
I remember going to a talk in London a year or so ago with Scylla Elworthy, who is a campaigner for world peace. And she's written a book as well called Pioneering the Possible, I think it's called. But she said at her talk, she said, what these companies, that the big, you know, the big five and those sorts of the big blue chip companies that are losing their grip on graduates and things like that coming through, she said, millennials need to be at the boardroom table.
Mm-hmm.
And the look on the face of most of the corporates in the room was an absolute shock and horror. But she was right. You know, as you say, these are the ideas people. These are the people. This is where the future's going. And if you're not including them in the conversation from the beginning, then you're losing grip.
The world is going to change so much in the next few years. We think we've seen it change up until now. But I think that the combination of the changing values of people combined with the opportunities provided by technology, is going to completely revolutionize the way that people and their relationship with work evolves and changes. I think the other thing is that we've had a fairly top-down approach to wisdom generationally. I mean, we are probably the last generation that will think that agent experience is the primary source of wisdom. I think that actually, when you look at the future of digital economies, when you look at new forms of communication on social media and other sorts of things, is that actually you'll see that millennials and the generations to come may well be pioneering generations that have got such immense value to provide to corporate conversations. And it won't be just tokenism that will deliver a more important place for younger people. I think it will be by right, because that will be the world in which we're living in. And I think, you know, for any parent that, you know, looks at their kids sort of, you know, technological prowess and sort of wonders, what is it I've got left to teach them? Well, imagine that in a corporate environment in 10 years time, where I think that, and, you know, and you could see that in the profile of entrepreneurship. I mean, the fastest growing segment of entrepreneurs is that 16 to 24 year old age group. And these are people that are taking destiny into their own hands. I mean, they increasingly want to make jobs, not take jobs. And I think that it sort of speaks to a future economy that I think it's so exciting to be a part of. And I think that they are increasingly, you know, mission-driven businesses. I think quite often what I find is amongst younger entrepreneurs is that the sense of mission is it's hardwired into the DNA of these organizations, because they are such, you know, optimistic and disruptive and challenging environments. And in many respects, a lot of bigger firms, a lot of more established firms, I mean, these are the companies that have got more to worry about, because, you know, in many respects, this emerging economy speaks to the nimble, the fleet of foot, and those that are thinking about tomorrow as a marketplace that they can prosper in, not one that they should be fearful of and nervous of.
Yeah, wonderful. It's so exciting, like you say.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, I mean, there are other areas of the world that I think, you know, quite rightfully, we should be pessimistic about in terms of, you know, sort of people movement, the environment, yeah. in many of those things. But I also sort of feel that, you know, so often we've thought about the solutions to many of these things as only coming from the state. And I do wonder whether many of the answers to some of today's terrible issues will come from businesses that have thought it through. When you look at sort of advances in things like big data and other sorts of things that can improve, use technology to improve everything from health to the prediction of, you know, sort of life-threatening diseases. I think that, you know, business has got such an important part to play in the world in which we live. And I think that is also its greatest opportunity.
It certainly is. And you're right about, you know, the darker issues on the plate that we're all witness to every day at the moment. And marrying that, or the potential of marrying that with business and this spirit of entrepreneurship, I think there's huge potential there. And
yes.
I think we're only just beginning to see not even the tip of the iceberg yet.
Well, I mean, and I think just to illustrate that, I mean, you know, we worked last year with a big data company that could actually help the United Nations track how the Ebola virus would mutate, because its data predictions could show you that, you know, that same technology will be at the heart of how US hospitals will be able to take patients into beds that can immediately identify who that person will be. And by so doing, will save huge numbers of lives through, you know, the sort of the bureaucracy and the issues of a effectively human-driven approach to checking people into hospitals in the States. And I think they're just small illustrations that collectively make a really big difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Yeah, so that process I've been through myself quite a bit with yeah. members of my family, and it is slow when it could be so much quicker. Absolutely.
I think we as a society have to get beyond, you know, the discussions of what is it that the state does. Is it, you know, it's not about privatization of the NHS. It's not about public versus private. It's just about a collaborative economy where business can do so much more if we take the basic point of view that the starting point should be that if it's trying to do good things, it should be encouraged. It should be welcomed in. It should, you know, there should be a way that is found for these organizations to flourish because they will change the world in which we live because their technologies and their innovation will do everything from healthcare to future cities to driverless cars. And I think that is a future which is worth being optimistic about.
Absolutely. Business as usual is over, so you said. Belief is a new currency, and to succeed, you must follow the new rules. Purpose as a route to profit. Mind share to gain market share. The best in business are defined by mission, a singular cause, and a defining ambition. I love that. And it just in that one sentence, you encapsulate pretty much everything we've spoken about.
Exactly. You could have read that in the beginning, Amy. Yeah.
And I love the whole idea about campaigning as well, really about getting out there and communicating and telling your story. As we come back to that, it really is so powerful.
Absolutely.
And about not sort of coming from the top down anymore. There is a quote in chapter 6 of your book about culture, which is also something phenomenally important in business. And it's by Seth Godin, who's somebody else I follow a lot online. Tribes form horizontally. Change happens from person to person, rarely from the top down. And I feel that really also just looking at what we've been talking about now in terms of businesses being able to step up and finding the platforms that you've also helped to create to stand on and give and being given the opportunity, finding and being given the opportunity to take their ideas, to the next level, take them nationally and globally.
Absolutely. And, you know, he said, actually, funny enough, Seth Godin said another quote, which I think I would see as a companion piece of that. He said that ideas are like viruses. They need sneezes to spread the message. So if you think about it, your idea is the mission, right? And the sneezes are the people that are going to tell that story. And I think that the reason why top-down missions tend to fail at the first hurdle is because they lack the authenticity. They lack the kind of, I guess, the basic democracy of the fact that actually we do tend to organize as societies into very tribal settings. And I think that, you know, firms that seem, I would say the tribe as a metaphor for the firms that we met is a really good one, actually, because so many of these companies seem to have democratized belief. They seem to have found the buy-in, and it would be far too easy to say that's on because it's on, you know, the financials. I think it was on a much more soulful level, which is that somehow that sense of mission, that sense of drive, that sense of organizing purpose seemed to be something that everybody owned. And I think that is the success of companies, both large and small, when they really have the benefits of mission.
Wonderful. What a brilliant closing statement. We've come to the top of the hour, Michael, and I feel like we could talk for hours. So this was Amy Hackett-Jones of Being Brilliant interviewing Michael Heyman, MBE. You can follow Michael at weare7hills.com. You can find his book called Mission by Michael Heyman and Nick Giles on Amazon. You can follow his events, not events, what do we call them? It's at Startup Britain and at Pitch at Palace. And go check out madefestival.org, which he's also been involved in. So this is Amy Hackett-Jones saying goodbye for now to Michael Heyman. Thank you so much. This was episode number 17. Thank you very much for listening. Go out there, all of you. Be your brilliant selves. And until next time, ciao for now.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.